supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. So, I've got a story to tell on this show about how stress gets passed down from parent to child. My daughter Debbie was about 3 or 4 years old, and we were at Children's Hospital waiting for her to get her tonsillectomy. And there she is wearing her little pajamas with feet and her bangs and black hair, and we're pacing outside. And we're holding hands, and she says to me, "Daddy, are you nervous about my operation?" Well, you know, I knew the research back then, and I knew if I lied, she would know. And I said, "Yeah, honey, I'm a little nervous." And she looks at me and she says, "Well, what are you nervous about, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, I'm nervous that if the operation doesn't work, you'll still get a lot of colds." So she stops for a minute and she looks up at me and she says, "No, Daddy," she said, "that's not what you're worried about." I said, "Honey, what do you think I'm worried about?" She said, "Daddy, you're worried that I'm going to die in there." Thud. She was right. I couldn't even let myself know it. Tofu. Tofu. These little beings are tofu. They absorb the emotion in the environment. Every parent has a similar story. Unfortunately, some children just absorb their parents' stress without talking about it. And in some cases, the children are too young to talk at all. Today's show is about stress contagion. We've got three excellent guests to help us understand what it means for us individually. Dr. Tamar Chansky is a well-known child psychologist specializing in children's anxiety disorders. She's the author of Freeing Your Child from Anxiety and a dear friend of mine. Tamar, welcome.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Wendy Mendez, she is the Ekman Chair in the Study of Human Emotion at the University of San Francisco. She's head of the Emotion, Health, and Psychophysiology Lab. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
And Dr. Sarah Waters is a postdoctoral member of the same lab. She recently conducted a widely discussed study on the physiologic transmission of stress from mother to infant. Our number here is 888-477-9499. If you are worried about transmitting your stress to your child, if the topic stresses you out, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Tamar, let's start with you. Emotional contagion, or what we call synchrony, is at the heart of parent-child relationships. If there is synchrony, a child feels felt, feels understood. But without it, there's difficulty in bonding. Tell us about what developmental psychologists call goodness of fit.
Well, I think, Dan, that the way to look at this really is in any given moment, the parent is feeling something, the child is feeling something. It's sort of incumbent on the parent to be picking up on the cues of what the child's feeling and to be attuned to that, reflecting that. What does that do for a child if there is that synchrony? Is that there is sort of that internal feeling of all is well in the world. Imagine if there isn't that synchrony or there isn't that matching, lots of things sort of fall out from that. The child in the immediate doesn't feel understood, but over time there's just a pattern of maybe as they get older sort of doubting what their own experience is, feeling bad about that experience. But even I think we're going to be talking about infants and early on, but there's that feeling of dis-ease that happens within the young child's experience.
Wendy, I want to turn to you, and I want to understand what this phenomenon is, is what's really going on here when we encounter, even as adults, someone who's angry or depressed. We feel our chest tighten. I mean, there's got to be some evolutionary purpose of that.
Right, absolutely. So when we think about two adults interacting, what we often will see is a lot of mimicry. People mimic the posture, the facial expressions, maybe even something like the word choice. And that helps facilitate interactions. We're more likely to mimic people who we like, and people who mimic us, we're more likely to like them. So it does serve a special feature to not only bond and understand each other, but also to help facilitate empathy. If you're feeling sad and I mimic that facial expression, I'm sort of putting myself in your shoes. So that mimicry helps us both facilitate social bonding. It helps us understand or have a shared reality with the other person. Also could help us take the perspective of the other person, see the world through their eyes. And this can help all of our social bonding. And what we did in the study was really about taking this adult phenomenon that we know well with adults and with couples and ask, do infants, pre-verbal infants, actually have the same kind of mimicry? Can they catch the emotions and stress even before they have that exquisite ability of language?
Well, that sets up Sarah here. And you guys are kind of working together here.
At
several levels. You just passed off the interview to Sarah and Wendy, and I think you did a very nice job here. It was pretty seamless.
We mimic each other quite a bit.
So, Sarah, tell us about the study. I want to know what population you looked at and what you were looking for.
So as Wendy set up, we're really interested in thinking about synchrony or mimicry or this passing of an emotional experience from one individual to the other. And as Dr. Chomsky was mentioning, so much of the developmental literature has focused on the child, maybe elicited a stress response in the child, and then looked to see how the parent responds to that, is attuned to that. And so with this study, we kind of took the reverse. We looked at the parent, and we thought about what the mother is actually bringing into the situation and how the infant might be picking up on that and might be sensitive to that, thinking about it really from the perspective that this might be a very adaptive or functional or helpful thing, because we know that infants at this age, these babies were 13 months old, so they were maybe developing their first words, many of them not speaking at all yet, most of them not walking yet, so being held by their parents a lot. We know that right at this age, babies have already come to understand that their caregivers are really important sources of emotional information in the environment. So if they're in a strange kind of setting, like when you come into the lab and there's all of these experimenters and strangers interacting with you, that if you don't, as a baby, know exactly what's going on, you're going to look to your mom and look to her emotional response to see how to feel about the situation and what's going on.
Well, the lab that Wendy runs, Sarah, and that you work at is one of the words is psychophysiology. So let's talk about the physiology here. What's happening?
So we know that this emotional transmission can occur behaviorally, or we've looked at it behaviorally, looking at facial expressions and eye contact and things like that. What we were doing was taking it to another level to look at what goes on in the mother's body physiologically, so things like heart rate, things like activation of the sympathetic nervous system, this fight or flight kind of stress response inside the body, how those changes occur in the mother, and then whether we see similar or comparable or synchronized changes in the infant.
How do you measure it?
We use things like electrocardiography, so EKG, kind of like what would happen, when you go to your cardiologist, where they put little skin sensors on your body, and then we're recording each heartbeat, each change in the cardiovascular system into the computer.
I wonder, Wendy, back to you, I wonder if what we're seeing here is kind of empathy in the extreme. You know, I know you can't use the word empathy with infants, but, the physiology is similar.
Right. Well, so I mean, I think it's fair to say that one of the emotions or mental states that helps with synchrony is empathy, trying to take the perspective of the other. I think with the current study that we're talking about, you're probably right that with babies, it's not so much empathy but more attunement to the mother. So what was sort of remarkable about this study was that the mother experienced something very stressful when the baby was in a different room, completely separated from the mother, or she experienced something very relaxed. And when the baby was reunited with the mother and placed on her lap, and instead of sort of relying on facial expressions or even voice frequency, what we simply looked at was a number of surface recordings from the mother and the baby. And what we saw is that the baby's physiological responses matched the mother's within minutes. So if the mother experienced something very stressful, her sympathetic activation was elevated. And here a baby who comes into the room who had no knowledge, wasn't able to get any information from the environment that there was something stressful that just happened in that room.
So on a psychophysiologic level, the word I used in the introduction, tofu, is almost right.
It was, it's a fantastic word, and actually your description of your daughter waiting for her operation was actually a perfect setup because you mentioned holding her hand. We think touch is one of the likely mechanisms through which this stress contagion can occur. It could be lots of things, right? The baby could be looking at the mother's facial expression and responding to either a scared or concerned look. Maybe it's odor. You know, when we're stressed, we put out different scents, and maybe the baby is picking that up. In our study, when we reunited the baby, we put the baby right on the mother's lap, and the mother held onto the child. Touch is a powerful mechanism through which our emotions are communicated. And especially when you're thinking of 12, 13, and 14-month-old children, they're getting a lot of information from that touch. And so, though we didn't isolate touch in this current study that we're talking about, we think that touch is this likely mechanism, this process through which the babies are picking up on the mother's stress and then responding physiologically with changes in the baby's sympathetic nervous system response that then matches the mother.
All right, I want to take it the next step, and I'm going to ask all parents listening to me right now to please forgive me. But I want to talk about the parallels between interactions, a parent's interaction with an infant and a human's interaction with their dog. Now, stick with me here. So, you know, when an adult is feeling stressed and, you know, they pet their dog, they calm down. So when a parent is feeling stressed and they hold their child on their lap, I'm guessing they calm down also. Yes?
Well, we think so. You know, in this particular study, we were focused on the baby responding to the mother's stress response. But we do think we see some evidence that this, the presence of the baby, helped regulate or helped calm down the mother. I think those kinds of very careful study where you're focusing just on the on the parent or the caregiver's responses are very critical. It wasn't quite what we were doing here, but I think that intuition is right. Just ironically, about 10 years ago, I had a study with the presence of dogs and cats, and we put adults through a very stressful interaction, measured their physiological responses, their blood pressure changes, their cardiovascular changes, and they either did a stressful task very similar like what we did with the mothers and babies in the presence of their dog, their cat, or their spouse. And without question, the most stress buffering, the most beneficial effect on the stress response occurred when your beloved pet was present and your spouse was actually quite bad at helping regulate your stress. So I think there is some parallels there.
Yeah, you know, there's some ethical issues here. You know, in this country, we've got marital issues here, and people are getting married less, and here you are saying that pets are better than spouses. I want to.
Spouse was better than being alone, though. Being alone was the worst.
I want to turn to Tamar because I have a feeling that we're going to have a lot of parents out there that are already close to having anxiety disorders. Tamar, before we go to the caller, I want to know if you've got experience in your work with how parents and children can kind of together, you know, get more attuned to each other in a positive way.
Yeah, I was going to say get more attuned to each other, but also be aware of when anxiety is what is driving the parent. You know, it's a little harder when we're talking about 13-month-olds to mediate verbally, although you can. But if, let's say, you're sitting and talking to your 7-year-old who's really nervous about going to a dance class for the first time or something like that, and you're nervous for them too, but you have the ability to say to yourself and to your child, that's my worry talking. So part of me is worried about what's going to happen when you go to that class, because you haven't liked other classes that you've gone to. But another part of me is curious. Another part of me is kind of excited. How about you? You know, there's an opportunity there through language to take hold of your relationship with that anxiety.
And when you respond out of anxiety, you're probably giving advice or trying to talk them out of their anxiety, or what I call stupid parent talk, what we all tend to do. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mark on the line. Hey, Mark.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Extremely interesting, and this is actually my first call in, but I do listen to your show on a regular basis.
Thank you.
A number of years ago, my son is 26 now. He was born as our second child. And just before he was born, my wife's mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He was born, everything was fine, and my mother-in-law then died, I guess, about 8 months later. We went to see her every weekend. We lived about an hour and a half away. We went to see her every weekend and visited her as she got worse. And almost every weekend, my son was brought with my wife and myself to visit. And, you know, my mother-in-law was allowed to hold him and all that kind of stuff. My question is, I have many questions, but my specific question is, now having the knowledge of listening to you guys talk, which I didn't have back then, I'm wondering if you can just give me some ideas as to what type of an impact those interactions may have had on my son and also my wife.
Let me give you a rule of thumb about this, and then we'll turn to the real experts. It's never about the thing. It's always about what the thing means to us and how we deal with the thing. It's never about the thing. Tamar?
I'm nodding my head in agreement, you know, that this really, Mark, it's wide open. We're, you know, the basis of cognitive therapy, but really of life, if you think about it, is it's not the event. It's the story that we're telling ourselves about it and how we process that. And that could have been an incredibly bonding experience for you all as a family, potentially going through that. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's wide open.
Sarah, do you want to weigh in on that?
I totally agree. I was also nodding that it's the meaning that's made. And I think that one of the things that we can forget sometimes, because we want to be in these, you know, beautifully synchronous and attuned and positive states with our children, is that much of the time we're not synchronized. And actually, those periods where there's stress, where there's upset, where there's a lack of synchrony, is the opportunity for reparation. It's the opportunity to reconnect. And that's a very powerful message that you can teach with your child.
I see the clinician across from me nodding her head in agreement. You just made her happy.
My fMRI is going crazy right now, right?
All right. We've got to take a short break, mostly so I can clear my throat. We're talking about transmission of stress from parent to child. My guests are Tamar Chansky, Wendy Mendez, and Sarah Waters. And our number is 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open. And think about the other way, too. If you were raised by parents who were stressed, or your situation was stressful, or, you know, a parent who was depressed, give us a call. We'd like to hear about that, too. All right, we'll be back in just one short minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about emotional contagion, specifically transmission of stress from parent to child. Tamar Chansky is a child psychologist specializing in anxiety disorders. Wendy Mendez is a professor of psychology and head of the Emotion Health and Psychophysiology Lab at University of San Francisco. Sarah Waters is a postdoc in the same laboratory, and she's the one that did the study that prompted a lot of this discussion. I want to talk about what we can do about it. Wendy, I'm going to jump back to adults here. Mm-hmm. We know from the work of John Gottman that emotional synchrony is at the heart of good relationships, and no matter what relationship, can synchrony be cultivated, nurtured physiologically, psychologically, or biologically?
Well, you certainly can increase emotional synchrony with partners, but also with strangers. You know, some of these effects happen below awareness. We're not even aware that we mimic or achieve emotional convergence with people. In fact, one of my favorite studies out of Kent State, you'll love this study, Dan, because it took interviews, specifically Larry King interviews. What they did is they extracted this voice frequency from these Larry King interviews. What they found is that within a few minutes of two people talking to each other, in this case Larry King and somebody else, that the voice frequency converged, the two people's wow. pitch and voice frequency within a few minutes had sort of the similar cadence and low frequency signals. Now, I don't imagine that Larry King or the person he was interviewing were aware that the voice modulation that they went through in the first few minutes basically ended up matching each other. There was one other really interesting part of this finding was that they looked at the Larry King interviews when he was interviewing people who were presumably higher status to him, heads of state, royalty, and also interviews where he was interviewing somebody presumably lower status to Larry King. What they found is that the person who was higher status, the lower status person would modulate their voice to match the higher status person. So in other words, the higher status person sort of set the tone for the interview. If Larry King was interviewing a head of state, Larry King would modulate his voice. If his interviewee was presumably lower status, the interviewee would modulate their voice. Why I think this is an interesting finding and relevant here is that people have very little knowledge of the minor modifications they make to their behavior, their expressions, their voice. But again, it's partly in service to achieve affective synchrony or convergence with our partners.
You're right. I love the Larry King study. You're absolutely right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Miriam on the line. Hey, Miriam.
Oh, hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my phone call. I'm finding this conversation absolutely fascinating. I just left my home, my 21-year-old home from college, and has always suffered from a lot of anxiety. I had trichotillomania as a fifth grader, and the reason I'm calling is because I am curious about stress in utero. My first husband died when I was 27 years old. I found out I was pregnant 6 weeks after his death. And I had a 2.5-year-old daughter as well. And as much as I tried to make my home secure for these kids, my daughter is who I adore, I know that there were things that I went through physically that I just, there was no controlling the stress factor during that situation. And I have always felt that her anxiety, her, you know, the way that she operates were as a result of that stress.
Well, we're going to hear from Sarah in just one second, but I also would guess that right after the birth, and you were still in mourning, that you had to, well, even with the 2.5-year-old, right after the death, you had to steel yourself from your own grief and fear. God knows what other emotions you felt. You had to you could function.
It was a full time. It was a full plate. And, you know, I was quite aware that they depended on me to what extent. You know, I was young and, you know, didn't know everything. But I tried my best. And, yeah, certainly, I know that they had to be affected in some capacity.
Yeah.
Certainly,
well, it's
the second one more than the first.
It's a good guess, certainly. Let's hear what Sarah has to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, Miriam, it sounds like you were incredibly courageous through a really challenging time. And I think that, you know, there are two things. One, there is research emerging about pregnancy in the prenatal period as being a really important time for development, that the experiences of the mother, the psychological experience of stress and things like that, are part of the environment that the fetus is developing in and begins this bi-directional relationship between mother and infant, well, mother and fetus, right from the beginning. So there is something to that. And I think my other point is to really emphasize just how plastic or malleable or continually responsive and changing we are as people, even our physiology, even, you know, our stress systems and things like that. So that, and this was, we sort of began to touch on this with the previous caller, of you go through these really difficult times, and one of the opportunities that emerges is to be able to teach your child that we survive these things and we stay connected. And like Dan was mentioning, we can become even closer and learn to regulate and to manage and to make meaning of really powerfully tragic and intense emotions.
Yeah, Sarah, you even said that when we spoke to you next week, that stress is good fodder for resilience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That, you know, we of course, we want to protect our children and not let them be exposed to a lot of stressors. At the same time, overcoming challenges and even, you know, getting into a conflict and then finding resolution to that is actually a really important lesson. It builds it builds resilience. It helps us know that, because we can't protect our kids or ourselves or anyone from the challenges of life. You know, it just comes no matter what you do. And so being able to have that resilience and have that strength and know that, you know, you and your relationship can weather this storm, that's really powerful.
Miriam, thanks so much for your call. Tamar?
Yeah, I agree with what Sarah was saying, and I think one thing to the caller is that a child could develop anxiety and trichotillomania without that history too. So I just want to put that out. But clearly, the things that parents do to survive a situation, that's a model too. It's not just the stress; it's what you do with it, and also that. There's kind of a time and place for everything, and I've certainly seen kids who have gone through very difficult times early in their life, and they're at a point maybe in their teens or middle school years where they're really able to take it on and learn a lot from about themselves of how they got through.
Well, you know, I found that with both of my daughters shortly after the story I told about Debbie. She was 5 years old, and my other daughter, Allie, was six when I had my accident and became a quadriplegic. And right from the beginning, I mean, these kids lived with trauma, but they were also helping their dad, and they were also with me when I was trying to get ramps put in their schools. And so both of these women now care very deeply about the larger world. They've got great passion about, you know, helping, you know, one with people and the other with animals. So that's the good news about parental stress. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Pat on the line. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to be the day for parents of older children. In fact, Mary, both of the previous two callers sort of asked most of my questions, so I'll tell you that I am the child of a super, super, super stressed out pair of parents. My mother had a diagnosed narcissistic personality disorder with borderline tendencies, and so our house was always stressful, and basically I was the baby that you described in your opening, with as a child of dis-ease. You can probably hear in my voice that I'm still at 16, a child of dis-ease.
So
our lives changed dramatically when my mother died 7 years ago, and there's a lot more lightness and a lot more happiness throughout my siblings' families, through all of our families. But I'm concerned about what to do, because I know I passed the stress on in utero, so thank you, Miriam, for that question. And I know that I fostered it, and the stories that I told were not really logical, maybe, when my kids were younger.
Right. But there's
so I want to know what to do now.
Yeah, that's the question. Pat, I'm going to ask you to take your answer offline, because we don't have a great connection. But Tamar, what can we do to stop history from repeating itself generation after generation?
Right. A lot of times the parents I see, maybe not surprisingly, have anxiety themselves. They're coming in for their child, but they're struggling as well. And often I will say to them that their empathy can go one of two ways. Either they can use that to be predicting anxiety, you know, danger and threat in a situation, and sort of modeling that for their child and letting history repeat itself, or they can go a really different way with it. And through their understanding that they can really just be with their child, ask questions, share the job. I guess, you know, there have been studies that look at what are the mechanisms by which anxious parents may pass that on to their kids and with older kids. And one of the things that they do, we were talking about touch earlier in the program, is a parent kind of rubbing the child's shoulders when they're waiting to go, you know, into the doctor's office for the shot, is actually a way of sort of transmitting fear.
Yeah, it's what we talked about.
Right,
touch.
You're telling your child, okay, this is a dangerous situation, or this isn't a good situation, you know, so be on alert. But again, your empathy is a way of sort of stepping back and communicating with your child, asking them, like you did, Dan, what are you worried about? Let's talk about it.
There is something that I have brought up, I think, every show, and that's self-compassion. I mean, when you are anxious as a parent, you are anxious. When you are anxious, you need care. You need kindness and compassion. That's got to be step number one if you're going to be a good parent. Because I got to say, and Wendy, before we take our break, I'm going to turn to you on this. You know, if I was a parent listening to the show right now, I'd be scared to death. I'd feel like every emotion would be picked up by my child, and I dare not be a parent until I spent at least 5 years in some ashram in Tibet.
Well, we certainly wouldn't want people to walk away with that impression, and I think this is a perfect time to, you know, make the distinction between acute stress and chronic stress. The last caller, Pat, was really describing, you know, an oppressive, chronically stressful environment. I actually want to separate that for a moment because children who are raised in something, you know, more sort of chronic and always there, I feel like that's a different situation. We all have ups and downs in our everyday lives, people who work and good things and bad things happen. But that acute stress, it motivates us in some occasions. I'm not, you know, stress can be good for you. It also can be damaging. It's not completely straightforward that it's always bad. What Tamara and Sarah were saying before, the story that we make of it, the meaning we try to make out of it, I think the point is that when your child is picking up on your emotions, you can't just assume that, you know, only the bad emotions are getting through, the good emotions are getting through, but also that there can be something learned from the negative emotions that we learn to regulate. If somebody is angry and you learn to calm down kind of within the moment of anger, your child is picking up on that, learning how to regulate their emotions early on, because you're effective at regulating your emotions, is a powerful skill to learn early.
That's really the deal. And the other thing and is that, you know, biology is not destiny.
That's right. And
Tamar has thousands of examples of that in, you know, in her clinical practice. All right, we've got to take another short break. We're talking about transmission of stress and, I guess, emotions in general between parent and child. We're talking with Tamar Chansky, a local psychologist, author of Freeing Your Child from Anxiety. Wendy Mendez, she's a professor of psychology and head of the Emotion Health and Psychophysiology Lab at the University of San Francisco. Sarah Waters is her postdoc, member of the same laboratory, and she did this really interesting study that hopefully will trigger lots more follow-up. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Penn Program for Mindfulness provides tools for coping, personal growth, and transformation. 8-week foundation courses combine mindfulness techniques with cognitive science to help teach participants to change the way they experience the world. Participants will learn how mindfulness is used to manage life's biggest challenges. Courses begin in September, January, and April. More at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2774. On May 30th and 31st, the program will host renowned mindfulness teacher Sharon Salzberg.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about contagion, emotional contagion, with Wendy Mendez, Sarah Waters, and Tamar Chansky, psychologists all. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jean on the line. Hi, Jean.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. My question is, we have a family member who's been recently in a major hospital, and he's returning home with his family, along with his wife, to two young kids. He's recently been diagnosed with ALS, early onset. And he's struggling with how to approach his two children, their ages 6 and 4, with the news, and also how to work with them on an ongoing basis in terms of the effects of this disease over the course of time.
Well, I'm going to turn that over to Tamar, but before I do, I just want you to know how very, very sorry I am for you and your family members. This is just so very heartbreaking. My heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
Tamar?
Likewise, Jean. And you know, Dan was talking a minute ago about self-compassion and self-care, and I think that the press in these situations is to immediately think about, you know, how you're going to tell the kids what you're going to do, and I think that taking the time as much as is possible to, you know, settle for them to settle themselves and really understand where they are. There's, again, we've been talking about attunement, reading parents' faces. You know, kids will not listen. They won't hear the words that parents are saying about an illness, a death, you know, news, whatever it is. They will just be watching your face to see, is this going to be okay? Is this out of control? So I think taking some of the pressure off to know that you don't have to, your family doesn't have to talk about this until they're ready, and also that this is going to be a process over time. And emphasizing, I think, even when it's a very sad and difficult situation, that there are people involved who are helping. That's so important for kids to know. And also, what are the very concrete things that kids can do to help? You know, Dan was talking, you're talking about your daughters helping you with various things. Everybody, we feel better when we have a purpose, when we stay connected, and that is a way to stay connected.
Yeah, and please remember, Jean, that this is a crisis for your family, and for the children, there's no urgency to say anything right now. That I agree with Tamar 100%. Please, please take care of yourselves, treat yourselves with kindness, and open up when you're ready. And please don't go into more detail than the children need. You know, sometimes we go into too much detail out of our own anxiety. So come from a place of love, a love for your children, a love for each other, and, you know, a love for this family. So I wish you the best, Jean, and I certainly hope what Tamar said was helpful.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
So much.
Take care. I want to know about this transmission business a little more. That if I come home and I'm feeling distressed, and there's a little baby there, should I keep my distance? I guess I'll turn to you, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly where what people wonder, or where our minds go when we think about this stuff. And I don't think that that's the message. We know that that babies love to be connected, that they come into the world right from the beginning really primed for social connection, gazing into their caregiver's faces and learning that social smile right from the beginning. I think that what we do want to kind of put out there, suggest from this study, is to be, use the word self-compassion, or to be mindful of your own distress, of what you're bringing into that interaction with the baby. And we talked a little bit before about whether it's soothing to the mother to pick up and hold that baby. So are you coming to your child sort of in the moment? And I think that it's very easy to... there's maybe no other time that it's easier to let go of the stress that happened a few moments ago, to let go of the future and all of the unknowns, and to just be present and in the moment when you're gazing into your baby's eyes and doing, you know, those sort of verbal and nonverbal dances that you can do.
And if you're in the midst of a crisis, if you can do that for 30 seconds, it's a good thing.
And exactly.
Don't expect yourself to be able to do a whole lot more. Than 30 seconds before your mind takes you away. I want to turn to you, Tamar, about reparation of all this stuff. You've worked with children and adolescents who've had severe trauma in their childhood, where their parents have undergone great stress and or depression. Who's got the better prognosis and why? And what is the work that needs to be done?
Well, I want to put out the message that I think Wendy or Sarah was talking earlier about plasticity, neuroplasticity. I think who has the better prognosis. Let's compete for that. Yeah. Why not everybody, really? That so many times in the process of parents observing their kids have a better opportunity than they did to change their relationship with anxiety, change their relationship with themselves and their lives, that parents start to grow from that too. And so I think that the opportunity is there really for everyone to be able to not just get run over by this, really.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Carrie on the line. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Dan. This is phenomenal. Phenomenal show. And here's my question. I'm a person who is adopted, and the topic is something that has always been a question for me about the level of anxiety that I believe I picked up in utero, and contrasting that with the nature-nurture, you know, what happened also in my own adoptive home where I had a very anxious mother as well.
So your question is, what did you get from whom?
Yes.
So let me ask you one other question. Why do you want to know?
You know, partially, it's to understand the nature versus nurture debate, and also, you know, I teach folks at the community college in behavioral health human services, and it's talking about family dynamics is near and dear to me. So it's sort of twofold.
Well, let me suggest a third fold too. Because when I said why to you, there was about two full seconds when you didn't have an answer.
Yeah.
And that's the third fold. And that's where you're going to learn something about yourself. Because that silence says, I don't know the answer. So I'm going to suggest something to you, Carrie, that there's something you want here. And it goes beyond information. Just a guess.
Mm-hmm.
What do I know? I'm a radio shrink, you know. Really, really, don't take me too seriously. It's just a guess. So I'm going to ask my guest to comment on our new relationship, Carrie, and I'm going to ask you to take the rest offline. Take care of yourself.
All right. Thank you.
And I think Carrie's question couldn't be answered by really anybody. I mean, there are certainly research that shows strong genetic factors, and then every day there's research that shows that the environment influences the genetic expression. So this long-standing question, it just doesn't have a simple answer. But what I see, the tide in research is showing how powerful how we think about the contributions of our experiences, the stories we make, the narrative that we tell ourselves, how powerful that is going forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I would have said to Carrie.
I want to talk about the reality that our world is more stressful, and I guess I'll turn to you tomorrow. The reality is our world is more stressful, and what can we do to protect ourselves and our children, if anything? No, nobody is really going to change their lifestyle. Nobody's going to stop and smell their roses. Bumper stickers don't cure people.
Gosh, Dan, I'm not sure I agree with that.
Right, next guest.
Right, so the 5 years at the ashram. Yeah. Well, no, I actually very, very seriously mean this, that I think that the world's pace is not going to change. But we do have some decision-making power in our own day, and our children need to see that too.
What I meant my language literally. Nobody is going to stop and change their whole lifestyle. You know,
right.
We're not going to rethink all of our values and change jobs and so on and so forth. But there are other ways of doing it. And part of my concern is with discussions like this, that too often the message goes out and we say, well, you've got to change your whole life to fix your kids.
Right. No, have dinner together once a week. Every day if you can, but once a week would be great. And have conversation during that dinner. TV off. Oh, my gosh, what that could do right there.
Whoever heard of that? I want to turn to you for the last comment. Wendy, it seems the takeaway message here is that parents need to take better care of their lives, and that's not just psychobabble. Your kids really do depend on it.
Right. I think the take-home message that was that these very young infants can pick up on what we may not always intuitively believe that they can detect these signals. But I also would want to end with saying we don't necessarily see anything wrong with a baby picking up even these short-term negative emotions. We think that's part of attunement. We would have been much concerned for babies, and the follow-up study would be something like you take mothers who are depressed, where we wouldn't expect to see the babies picking up on the negative emotions. So I think the story is that it's okay.
Yeah.
That, you know, negative emotions are not always damaging. It's part of our life, and it's about regulating them that I think is the most powerful message. That
all right, so what you've just done is cut down on the ashram tourist trade. Listen, I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. And Sarah, hats off to you for this really important study, and please keep nagging at the funders. We need much, much more. So thanks to all three of you. It's been a great show. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about wisdom, specifically wisdom as we age. What is it? How does it work? And by the way, I'm going to be doing a reading tomorrow night, Tuesday night, at Head House Books on 2nd Street, right off South Street. Well, to download our podcast, we're at whyy.org/voices. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, where I've got an interesting new essay about my South Africa trip. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Relax.
Here and Now is next on